Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone. This is Batavila Mtombeni. I'm your host, and you're listening to Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am here with Dean Killian, who is an NBC trainer, and we're going to get into more of what she does. But for those of you who might be listening live, I will understand that you might be a little bit confused. We've gotten a little bit of a late start. Due to some interesting confluence of events, sometimes they say things happen in threes, and if anything could go wrong today, it did. Except that I'm really happy to be here with Ian. And we're hoping we're coming through to you loud and clear. We're actually broadcasting from my cell phone and we're on speakerphone. So this is a new adventure for me and I guess for Ian.
It is. I think my voice carries well. We'll see.
So we're going to carry on, and soldier on with doing the show. Dean, I'm so glad that we have the chance to chat with each other, talk a bit about what you do in your life, and you know, all kinds of interesting things. The show is about stories, and so I'm eager to hear your story.
Great. Well, I really appreciate you inviting me.
Oh, good. So I'd like to start back at the beginning. I'd like to talk with folks about their earliest influences and how those might have contributed to them ending up in the field that they're in, and you are specifically in nonviolent communication. You grew up here on the East Coast, you said in New York, and then also New England.
I was born here in New York City. I just want to check, though, if you think everyone knows what nonviolent communication is, because this is using the listeners for the show.
Okay. Sure.
So we're used to explaining it. So
we will get to that.
Okay.
And I definitely want folks to know what it is. I didn't know what it was until we met, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd heard about it, but I didn't really know anything about it until we met.
Okay.
So we will talk about exactly what nonviolent communication is, but let's start.
Sure, it's a biography.
Yeah.
Well, I am a native New Yorker, and I'm very proud of that. I'm a third and fourth generation New Yorker. You know, on both sides of my family. And while I was born here, though, when I was about 5 years old, we moved up to New England, so I primarily grew up in New England. But it's interesting. I think, you know, coming from a family of New Yorkers, even though we were living outside New York City, in my opinion, there's a certain way that we communicate as New Yorkers, and there's a different style in New England, especially around, like, I would say an Ivy League campus, and my stepfather was working at Brown University, and that kind of, I think, informed my early understanding of conflict, because while I would say my family had its challenges, I think I had a distorted view, because there was a certain way that I think New York was communicating, a very frank way, very down-to-earth way. And in New England, you know, it depends on the culture you're from. And overall, I think there's a different way of discoursing or quality of discourse. So that kind of informed my impression of how my family was communicating early on. It wasn't until I came back to New York, I was like, oh,
everybody doesn't like
it. Yeah, it's not quite as dysfunctional as I thought. We're just New Yorkers. But so that was kind of an early influence.
Yeah.
But I was really glad to come back to New York. I lived in New York for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I lived in the Midwest for a while, and I really feel at home in New York.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were in New England and you're experiencing this difference between how your family communicates and how what might happen outside of your friends' homes, perhaps, is where you picked it up?
Yes. Yeah. And just general discourse on the street. I mean, I know that's maybe kind of a generalization. But, I mean, okay, if I was going to characterize it, I would say in my home, interrupting, talking over each other more, a different level of, like, sarcasm that's almost a form of affection. You know, it's like, you know, half of my family, even though I was raised Protestant, my father was raised Protestant, half my family is of Jewish background, my mother's side of the family is Protestant, but, you know, New York, you know, third generation New Yorkers, so different cultural influences there, but I definitely noticed that when I beat my friend's house, friend's home, that it's just, you know, different levels of discourse.
More quiet, perhaps, polite?
Yes, and I don't know, different than Midwest, but I lived in the Midwest for a while, and I definitely see a difference in how Midwesterners, you know, and again, it's a generalization.
Sure.
But there's a certain way, you know, that I feel definitely at home in New York City culture and how we, even if nothing else, the pace.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. There's a speed at which we talk. And I say we. I've become an honorary New Yorker, I think, although people who were born and bred here might disagree, but, you know, it's been 10 years, and that's grateful that one can call oneself a New Yorker after 10 years.
Well, it's funny, even though I wasn't primarily raised here, again, just my parents and my grandparents, my cousins, everyone are from New York City, and so that's kind of like the family's culture.
So you spent how much time was it in New England?
I lived in New England for about 15 years.
Ah, so that's significant. And
yeah.
So you were 20 or so when you left.
And then I came back to this area and did my bachelor's degree at Rutgers University.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went over to Ireland. I did a master of philosophy degree in Irish cultural studies at Trinity College Dublin. And I lived in Europe for about 8 years. And then I came back and was in the Midwest for a while. And when I had an opportunity to come back here to New York, I really jumped at it because I just knew I wanted to be back in New York City. And when I first moved back to New York, I was working as a union organizer for the National Writers Union. And that was definitely one influence in, or motivating factor in me becoming an NBC trainer. I don't think there was anything, you know, special in this way about the Writers Union. Anytime you have a group of organization, being a group of human beings, there's going to be some misunderstanding and conflict. And I had known about nonviolent communication, I'd studied it a bit before, and then I did an interview with Marshall Rosenberg, who created the model for the Sun magazine.
How did you come, oh, I see, so were you writing for Sun magazine?
Yeah, I was, while I was in the Midwest, I was working, among other things, as a freelance journalist and a contributing writer for an alternative paper that's owned by the Village Voice now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like kind of like the Village Voice,
mm-hmm.
where I was living. And I had known about NBC, and I'd done a story about Marshall for the paper I was writing for locally. And I really liked the interviews in the Sun magazine because it's one of the few places, I don't know if listeners know the Sun magazine, published out of Chapel Hill. It's one of the few magazines that I know of that do political type interviews or, you know, about things to deal with politics or activism. That's like a 7,000 word interview. It's like one of the longest interviews. And so I really wanted a chance to do that kind of interview with Marshall.
Yes.
So what's kind of interesting backstory to that, I queried the Sun, and their initial response, I don't tell a story very often, and knowing who the listeners are, I think we'll find this interesting. The Sun's initial response was, we had someone once before who did an interview on conflict resolution, and we didn't find it very compelling. It was kind of, you know, flat. I think their evaluation was something like that. And I assured them that if I did an interview, I guess it's like, again, that New York energy, I said, this is going to have a bite to it.
Yes.
And I think what worked really well is when I did the interview with Marshall, I had, you know, been to some NBC workshops, and I had...
Why did you go to the NBC workshop?
Well, when I was in the Midwest, I was really active in a Quaker meeting, and the Quaker meeting had sponsored a workshop because, you know, Quakers have a tradition of pacifism and nonviolence. So that's how I first found out about it, and as a journalist, you know, I had heard that Marshall leads these workshops for adults with puppets, which I found kind of intriguing. I hate to have that as the main association people have with nonviolent communication. Having said that, I think the puppets work quite well for Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
He does role plays with them and brings some humor in. You know, one belief I have is sometimes people hear about conflict resolution and they already start to pull back, even hearing the word conflict.
Right.
So bringing puppets in, which is something that no one really is expecting, brings in kind of a sublime, ridiculous element, which helps people relax and actually learn how to practice this skill, I think, easier.
Right.
So I'm someone who doesn't use the puppets very much. I just prefer to do role plays with participants.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few trainers like to use the puppets, and, you know, I can see why Marshall did that. But anyway, that was, I heard about that, and that just sounded really funny to me, so I thought this could be a good story,
mm-hmm.
my journalist cap on. So I went to a workshop, and actually I found what he was doing very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a practice group where I was living for about 8 or 9 months with one of the original founders of the center, International Center with Marshall, who's one of the first certified trainers, Peter Herzog. And then I got busy with other things. I was working on a PhD and you know, working as a journalist. And then I, you know, got work with the Writers Union. And I was still doing journalism on the side, but also I saw what was going on in the union and the kinds of conflicts that were coming up. And, you know, I did this interview with Marshall, and when I did it, I hadn't completely bought into the whole model. I was interested in it. And in the course of the interview, I got to ask him all of the doubters' questions that I had, actually, at that point. And I found his responses so compelling, including about political issues, that I really became much more interested in NBC again, and then, you know, did a 9-day intensive training, and then did the North American Leadership Training Program in California, and was asked to be an assistant trainer in that program, so I was involved in that program for 2 years, and then got sufficiently excited that I decided to leave my job as a union organizer and start a nonprofit center here in New York City for nonviolent communication.
Wow. What a journey you're describing, and I know we want to hear more about that. I actually want to take a moment and pause because we want folks to be able to listen live to the show and to call in if they have questions. I know that a lot of people are going to be listening to this as a recording, but I'm going to take a moment and say a little piece and that gives me a chance to actually send out an email.
Sure.
To the NYCDR listserv so that anybody who is looking forward to hearing you live and perhaps calling in can do that. So I'm going to play a little piece called Race Face. It's from an album called Costume by one of my favorite musicians, Brandon Ross. He's a master guitarist and a singer-songwriter. So this is an original work by him. Good. Okay, so we're going to take just a moment and we'll be right back. hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. It may be that we were on the air all this time. I can't be sure. I'm broadcasting from my phone, which I've not done before, completely from my phone. We had a problem with internet access, and so I haven't been able to access the show from my computer as I'm used to doing. So this is all a big adventure for both Dean and I, and for you as well, I suppose. I just took a moment to send out an email letting folks know that we are broadcasting and letting them know that they can go ahead and call in. So we want to continue with your story, Dean. You said that you were so inspired by what you've discovered about NVC and that you decided to actually quit your job eventually and come to New York and start a center. When did you start your center?
Well, I was already here in New York working for the Writers Union, and it was like January 2004 mm-hmm. that I started the center. And although it wasn't until the following year that I quit my job, and that's when it really took off, I just realized working full-time as a union organizer and trying to get a nonprofit going. So I had managed to put aside some savings. So I was hoping at some point to buy an apartment with or have as a deposit and invested that money in getting started.
What was your purpose when you decided to start the center?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in having an impact on the world. And, you know, there's different ways to do that. So, you know, being a union organizer is one way. For years when I was a journalist, I wrote about social and political issues. And I became really inspired about NVC, nonviolent communication, as a way that could really change how systems function, society functions, really at every level, how we communicate with ourselves. I often say at workshops that I think the greatest amount of violence that goes on every day is, you know, how we talk to ourselves and our own skin.
Oh, yes. Anyway.
So how we speak with ourselves, how we communicate in our families, how we talk to others, how groups and organizations function. And, you know, my PhD concerned cultural studies and critical and narrative theory. And so I was studying a lot of theories like Foucault and mm-hmm. Derrida and Bakhtinian, you know, theory. And it seemed to me what Marshall was doing, even though he came from a psychology background and it wasn't coming from a, you know, cultural studies perspective, it really was a response in my mind to a lot of what I studied in my PhD in terms mm-hmm. of, like, especially Foucault and Derrida. And, you know, you can deconstruct things, but as, you know, is commonly known in cultural studies, the system kind of perpetuates itself. So NVC offered, in my mind, a third way, mm-hmm. like a third rail to really respond to the domination structures in society.
So how does NVC avoid the problem of reinventing the wheel, so much as reasserting the paradigm?
Sure. Yeah. Well, let me give you my assessment of how kind of what business as usual looks like mm-hmm. in our world. And I'm coming, you know, from a background as an activist with deep respect, by the way, for the labor movement, deep respect for activist movement. So I different strategies can be effective. So I'm just wanting to say that up front because I have a lot of respect for strategies that have been used, but I'm going to give my analysis of what I see of what has gone on historically. So when you have a system of power over, the dominant system holds the power. And then you have other people in society that are trying to take that power. And if you look at any, you know, movement from, you know, civil rights movement to women's suffrage movement, it's about trying to get that power, redefining power. But it's still within that whole system of who's going to have the power. And you can use you know, different strategies like demonstrations or sit-ins, whatever, to in that power, but it's still within that paradigm of who's going to have power. It's still power over. What nonviolent communication offers as a model is power sharing, including social change. And my belief is that as long as we continue in a power over, you know, because I saw that again, with deepest respect for the labor movement, I have a lot of respect for the movement, that power over paradigm, it's still perpetuating the same paradigm. I'm looking at a way to get them from the outside of it.
Now, how are you going to share power with a power that is greater than you that's not interested in sharing?
Well, for me, the example that inspires me is Gandhi. And, you know, Gandhi spoke about how he, given a choice between someone coming from a place of courage or cowardice, he'd rather have someone, use a violent means and have courage than someone be a pacifist and be a coward. So I mentioned it up front because one of the bumper stickers I like is peace also takes courage.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandhi's example, and also the civil rights movement example in the United States, which of course Martin Luther King Jr. was very much inspired by Gandhi and was very connected with his movement. So if you look at, you know, lots of examples from both those movements, people were willing, out of moral courage, moral dignity, to risk their own physical safety. So it's a different way of challenging power structures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, a lot of people got hurt. A lot of people get hurt with other measures as well. If you look at what creates long-term change, I think it's far more interesting and compelling to take the approach that Gandhi took. And Marshall Rosenberg called this practice nonviolent communication because he was inspired directly by Gandhian principles. He considers nonviolent communication a way of practicing on a daily basis and how we communicate and think about the world in alignment with what Gandhi taught.
So tell me a bit more then about how nonviolent communication actually works. What does that mean?
Right. Well, sure. Well, first of all, for those people who are unfamiliar with the model, the four basic steps of the NVC model, and I want to say, because I know listeners on this show are familiar with other forms of conflict resolution, and prior to learning NVC as a Quaker, I had studied the alternative to violence program, so I'm very familiar with that method. I have read a bit in other approaches as well, although the two that I know best are NVC and EVP. I'm mentioning all that because nothing is completely unique under the sun. So NVC, like a lot of other forms of conflict resolution, makes use of I statements, makes use of reflection or mirroring. I like to call it recapping, because it's a term that I think people get much more easily at trainings. When I say reflecting, I find people can often give their own opinion, like they were thinking about reflecting on it. I don't know if that makes sense. But recap makes it clear to kind of giving a headline summary of what the person said.
So it's what others in different forms of mediation might call paraphrasing.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, emotional intelligence is given a model for identifying what we're feeling. And other models, I think, also separate what in NVC we call the observation from the story. You know, what actually happened and what are we telling ourselves about what happened. What really stands out to me in the NVC model is the third step. So, by the way, just to reiterate, the first step of the model is coming up with what I would call a clean observation, re-evaluation. Second step is to identify what we're feeling, free of judgment. And it's very easy to mix judgment in English because you can say things like, I feel like you're an idiot. And of course, you know,
well, yes, it's a feeling.
Well, we're using the verb feel.
Yes.
And then there's other words like, you know, I feel misunderstood.
Oh, but it's still an opinion.
It's an opinion, exactly.
Right, yeah.
So that's something when I'm doing mediation or teaching NVC, really want to support people in recognizing, because otherwise, if you want to practice the model and people, you know, don't respond well, and they don't understand why. And if you say to someone, I feel like you misunderstand me, I feel like you're a jerk, of course they're going to, you know, not enjoy doing that because it's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So we really want to train people in distinguishing what we mean by a feeling. So a feeling is something, is an experience that goes on in our own skin. It's not because someone did something or said something to us. If you unpack, I feel misunderstood, what it really means is you did not understand me, which is very different from I'm frustrated or I'm disappointed, I'm sad, or I'm excited, I'm delighted, I'm feeling engaged. So it can be, you know, feelings around needs met, feelings around needs unmet. We want is about internal experience. So that's the second step of the model.
Would you mind if I, well, let's go through the steps. I'm trying to decide whether I want to query in just a moment, because the question I have is, okay, you say, I feel frustrated, and then what? I feel frustrated because, or
yeah.
I feel frustrated when?
Yeah,
or?
And this is where we go to the needs, and the needs are the real powerhouse of this model.
Mm-hmm.
And in the model, there's a key distinction for each step.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tagline and a key distinction. And then, so I've already shared the key distinction for the first two. For the third one, it's a need that's free of strategy, because in English and in other languages, we can say things like, I need a new car,
mm-hmm.
or I need, I need a new house or whatever. You can put an object as need. when we talk about needs in the NBC model, we're talking about abstract universal qualities that, in effect, no one can argue with, which is why the model is so powerful. But if I said to you, I'm really wanting some understanding, or I'm, needing support, or I'm needing a sense of choice, who can argue with those? Everyone can understand that we have those needs. What makes it especially powerful is the combination of giving the observation, how we're feeling in relation to that observation, what we're needing, and the fourth step of the model is making a request.
Mm-hmm.
So another way of looking at the model is the first step is about the external world. What am I seeing or hearing in the external world? Then we come inside. What's my response to the external world? What are my feelings and needs? Then we turn our focus to the external world. What request can I make that's going to meet my needs? This model is about ultimate responsibility. Other people may offer me a trigger. They may offer me the stimulus. It's ultimately my feelings and needs that are kind of coming up for me in response to the trigger. So I hope that makes sense.
It certainly does, and actually it helps to explain a little bit of something. I'll give you a little bit of background. My first really concrete experience with NBC was at Occupy Wall Street. And the first night I came, it was a Friday night, came to volunteer as a mediator. A message had gone out on the NYCDR listserv asking for mediators to come down, so I came, and I met a young woman named Tashi Enders, who is just fabulous. She's my heart. I love this woman. We met for the first time that night, and were asked to go and help mediate a situation, and I think there were about six mediators who were there, and a group of about 12 people. And so some of the people who were there expressed concern that there were just about as many mediators as there were parties. And so they decided to pick two people who would be the mediators, and they picked me and they picked Tashi. And she and I had never met. We had never worked together, but we said, okay, let's go. And her background in NBC proved to be just beyond, it was so awesome. And she and I shared this synergy because I didn't know what she was doing or how she was doing it, but I could see what it was doing, and it was great. And she didn't know what I was doing because she didn't have a background in mediation. She didn't have mediation training. But we were able to find ways to give it, and it came very organically, to give each other the space to do our thing in a way that was effective, to partner in a way that I had not experienced before, working in mediation. And so she did the empathy thing, and I did this sort of problem-solving thing, and, we were able to work really well together in that context. And that's also where I met you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was a Saturday afternoon. I was wandering through the park and saw the NBC table and came along and was like, wow, this is interesting. And you're sitting there in the park giving empathy.
Yeah, and Tashi, by the way, is who got me to come down. She found out about the center here in New York, or someone told her about it, and she asked me to come down and do a workshop for Occupy Wall Street, and that was the start of what became, I think, pretty much daily workshops while the occupation was going on. And first workshop had about 45, 50 people at it. It was outside the church, right on Broadway. It was pretty hard to hear. I don't know if you were there that day, but... And it was interesting, there was someone there who was triggered even by having someone lead a workshop. And people at first were like trying to get him away from the workshop so they could focus. And I said, hold on a second, let's dialogue with him. I want to hear, I didn't say that exactly, but I want to hear his concerns. And it actually became a really powerful example, real time, and what can happen when you listen to someone empathically. Because it just took maybe, 5 minutes of me listening to what was going on for this young man, and, well, I guess young compared to me. And once he had a sense of being heard, what I call the NBC magic happened.
Mm-hmm.
It just continues to amaze me, even though, I'm now a certified trainer, I've written 2 books on this topic. When I see it in real time happening again, it really almost is like a form of magic, what we are capable of as human beings when we really have an experience of being heard. And then it shifted for him, and not only did he give up attempting to disrupt the workshop and interrupt things, he stayed for 10 hours and gave me a hug because this was exactly where he needed to be. He got so much out of the workshop, and I was so glad that happened. Because to me, here's an example that can happen in activist circles from the best intentions. We want this meeting to go on. This person is causing a disruption. How do we get them out of the meeting? From my point of view, I'm not saying this would always be my strategy. It depends what's going on with the person, what's going on in the meeting. And I really loved in this moment the idea of what can we do to hear this person and make the circle a little bit wider to include him, which to me is totally in integrity with what NBC is all about. And I ultimately think the spirit of Occupy Wall Street, which really is wants to be an inclusive movement.
And the challenges of inclusion and concerns about inclusion were something that I was there from the beginning and carried through the entire time that folks were there in the park. One of the challenges of that continues to puzzle me, something I puzzle over, is the idea of remaining aware at all times or either it's our socialization or it's human impulse. I don't know enough to be able to say one way or the other. But we forget. Even with all the training I know for myself, even with all the training that I have, sometimes I feel as if I have to learn these lessons over again. I'll be involved in a conversation. Do you just raise your hand? I'll be involved in a conversation with somebody and all of a sudden come to an awareness that I'm being really argumentative.
Mm.
And this is not going well.
Mm.
It doesn't feel good. And
including in our body.
Yeah. And, and I should know better and all that kind of thing. And there's the judgment coming in, right?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Why do we keep going back to old habits?
Well, that's an interesting question as well. But, is it possible to come to a place where you are in such focus and awareness that you're not finding yourself in those situations?
Well, here's my take on that. Again, I go back to Gandhi. Another of my favorite Gandhi quotes, as he said, is no one ever becomes completely nonviolent.
Yes.
It's just a process, and we both get closer and closer to that goal.
Right.
And I can say that things that really triggered me, like 10 years ago, that I've practiced a lot of self-empathy around or been heard about empathically, they don't have the same trigger that they have for me. And partly through practicing NBC, it's not 100% of me. Like I said, it's a process, and you can always improve your tennis anymore, But you start to notice what your triggers are, and you become a little bit like old friends, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's you again, And, one piece that I work on, because when doing training, triggers come up a lot for people. They're wanting help when, basically they shut down in some form. They go into, when there's a conflict, I think we can really easily go into fight or flight. And one form of flight for people is that they kind of just disappear. If they have some kind of trauma in their lives before and there's conflict, I have a whole theory about this, and I'm not sure you're going to go into it now, but to keep it kind of simple, I think at a young age, when we experience some kind of trauma, it could be a conflict or our needs were unmet, we can very easily confuse that with physical safety. This is my theory anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is supported by work like Peter Levine, Waking the Tiger, and other people who do this kind of work around somatic memory.
Okay.
So when we're triggered in the present moment, we freeze. Some people may even kind of, leave the body, because there's some a traumatic experience. So you're not fully present, and you're kind of going back to that reaction that you had, maybe even precognitive. And it's not fully conscious. So I call these Loch Ness moments. I call them Loch Ness monster moments because the analogy I give, we're going through our day doing really well, sun shining, we're in the rowboat, we're having a picnic, and all of a sudden, oops, what's that? Something kind of pushes you from underneath the boat. Like that's something from our unconscious. And people who study these things say that 97% of our mind is unconscious. Kind of interesting. So we're only operating 3% of consciousness.
That's deep.
It is.
Literally and figuratively.
Well, here's the thing. We want to believe as human beings that we have self-control, that we have awareness, that we're rational. Although it's interesting, part of my academic background is also in classical and modern rhetoric. And, going back to the idea of persuasion, the classical rhetoricians actually argued that the emotional and ethical appeal were far more impactful on human beings and the rational appeal. We want to believe that the rational, in fact, was far more impacted. And it's interesting that the rhetoricians, 2,000 years ago in Greece, came up with that because current studies about how people make decisions and how our memory works suggest that it's very much connected to our emotions.
Of course. Yeah.
So, long story short, all of a sudden we don't even know. We're thinking we're just triggered by the current thing. Someone steps on our toe in the subway. But here's my litmus test for this. If I can just bring it back to the observation, someone steps on my toe, I talk a lot of self-empathy riding my bicycle in New York City.
Yeah.
On an observation level, a car door opens. That's all that happens. Everything else is story. Everything else is reaction. If I'm having like a level 10 response to a level 1 observation, that's indicating to me that it's some kind of old stuff that's being triggered for me. So when I can start thinking about it that way, it's a lot easier for me to have compassion for myself and self-empathy, really connect with my feelings and needs in the moment. And just to come back to the observation, I mean, each step of the MVC model works well together and works well independently. Because when I'm really triggered, again, just coming back to the observation, it's so liberating to me. Because when I was triggered riding my bicycle, you know, and it can still happen, I'm not riding as much as I used to, but I also have done a lot of self-empathy work around this, I would just globalize things so quickly. You know, again, like a car door open or someone pulls over in front of me, I would notice when I slowed down enough to notice the thoughts in my mind, it'd be things like, oh, this person doesn't care about the environment. And I just thought, wait a minute, how did them cutting me off and not caring, like, how did those get squished together?
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a story there, you know. And if I unpacked it, the whole story is, well, if they really cared about the environment, they would value me as a cyclist. They'd be paying attention. They would have the level of consideration and awareness of my safety that I want. But come on, I also drive a car. I know that when you're driving in New York City, you're paying attention to a lot of things. You also may be running late and thinking about what you're going to cook for dinner. So we're all human beings, and I'm sure the person was not thinking, let me run over the cyclist and ruin the environment, you know. So when I can unpack all of that, but what happens is I'm convinced from my own experience, leading workshops, doing mediation with couples and groups, that when we get triggered like that, we don't even pause long enough to notice what our thoughts are. We're taking our thoughts
flooding,
as the truth.
Right?
Exactly.
This idea of emotional flooding.
It's a tsunami.
Yeah.
And so the whole practice of NBC on one level is a mindfulness practice,
mm-hmm.
An awareness practice, to be able to go, okay, what was the trigger? What am I telling myself about the trigger? What are my judgments? What are my feelings, relations at my needs? And then what requests can I make? And what's interesting is when I was so triggered riding my bicycle, I was really focused on changing the drivers. And the drivers have to change their behavior. When I really got to a deep level of self-empathy, and I realized, okay, am I going to really educate every single person who's driving in New York City? Is that doable? One of the criteria for requests in NBC is that it's clear, positive, doable request. And when I really connected with that, I realized, you know something? You know, given my lifespan, it's probably not going to be possible that I educate every single driver, or that even every driver I educate every single moment is going to be driving the way I would like them to. So I started looking at a strategy, which included changing my bicycle route, making myself more visible. And it's funny, once I took responsibility for my own experience, I realized, like, I was cycling along J Street to the Manhattan Bridge. That is probably, in my opinion, one of the worst roads and bottlenecks anywhere in New York City, Brooklyn or Manhattan or anywhere, riding a bicycle. And when I looked at a bicycle map, there was actually a lovely path through, you know, VetroTech that went through, like, a park that was actually an official, like, bicycle path. And so it's kind of the path of least resistance.
There you go.
Yeah. You know? And I still do my best to educate drivers, but I'm also taking responsibility for my own experience.
Right. Ah, what a fantastic story and way of encapsulating how NBC can actually work in a particular way. We've got a couple of things going. One is that we are, I could go over in terms of recording, and that's fine. Folks who are listening could come back and listen to it. We have about 6 minutes left, but for some reason my cell phone has stopped charging. So what happened, right? 10% battery left.
What's
it's
going
interesting.
On
it's like, oh, something's going on. So I want to give you some time to talk about your books and then to also talk about about the center, and you have just a few minutes left. I'm sorry about
okay.
that. It's showing that it's
charging.
It's charging. It's just not.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that, but
so funny because the internet we have bars and we couldn't get the internet.
You know, and the only thing that's different is that I'm here. I don't know. It's a mystery. Anyway, so please go ahead and tell me about your books and then also then about the center.
Sure. The first book I actually co-wrote with Jane Cronner, like I mentioned earlier. It's called Connecting Across Differences, and it recently got published with a new, larger publisher in a second edition, and you can find it online at Amazon, or you know, I really would love for people to come to our website, which is collaborative-communication.org, and we have quite an extensive bookstore, online bookstore, and we'd love for you to buy the book if you're just in directly from us. But that book is a combined book and workbook on nonviolent communication. Mm-hmm. It was originally written as a college textbook, but it's been revised for general readership. And some things I hear about that I really enjoy is that it's considered the most comprehensive book on NBC available. And we really take a social change focus part of the book.
Okay.
So that's one book. The other book is one I wrote called Urban Empathy, True Life Adventures of Compassion on the Streets of New York. And a friend of mine who's a cartoon artist illustrated it. And it's like a graphic novel format, but it's not a novel, it's vignette. And it's all verbatim True Life examples of practicing nonviolent communication in New York City, including in some fairly intense situations, the kind of situations where us New Yorkers would just get out of the environment as quickly as possible rather than engage with people. So people would read it. And it's a range, though. It's not all intense situations. Some are with my family. Some are with the children of friends. And so there's really broad application, absolute strangers on the street. So that's called Urban Empathy.
Fantastic. And tell me briefly what you do here at the center.
Sure. The Center for Collaborative Communication, we started out called Brooklyn Nonviolent Communication, and we changed our name a few years ago. I like calling nonviolent communication collaborative communication, and it really speaks to what the practice is about. So we offer classes and workshops to the general public, including throughout the city at places like the 92nd Street Y, the New York Open Center, Capallo. Last year I taught at Omega. And I and those other trainers who work at the center, our real passion is bringing these skills into organizations. So we've worked with small nonprofits, with some staff of three, to large NGOs like the UN Development Program, to corporate 100 clients, Fortune 100 clients. And that's really thrilling for me because when you have a group of people learning NBC together in community, it supports everyone's learning.
Oh, sure.
And then it often impacts the organization. That's really been satisfying. And we also do mediation and coaching. So there's very broad application of these skills. And, you know, we're just interested in bringing them basically everywhere and anywhere that people want to learn them. We're a nonprofit, and our mission is to bring these skills out in the world. And our goal, we're gearing up to start a large campaign, where our goal is going to see 20,000 New Yorkers trained in nonviolent communication.
Wow. Very awesome. Why? A goal that you have, and I have a feeling you're going to achieve it.
Thank you.
Do me a favor, give me the name of the website one more time.
Sure. It's collaborative-communication.org, and I encourage listeners to visit and consider signing up for our email list. We send an email once a month that includes stories, exercises, upcoming events. We also have a Facebook page and a blog.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Dan, it's been awesome talking with you. I know that, you know, considering all the stuff that happened, your NBC spirit is what kept me calm and going, and I really, really appreciate that. I felt your empathy from the moment I walked in the door. And so to those of you who are listening, thank you so much for listening. I really enjoyed talking with Dan, and perhaps we might get you back at some point in the future. And we hope that you come back and listen to the next episode that we put up. This has been Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. Have a wonderful week, everyone.
Bye. Thank you. That's fun. The hour went so fast.
It really did. And we're still recording.
Okay. Hi, everybody.